Part 3. Lucien Carlier. Gentlemen of the human race, I say to hell with the lot of you. Victor Hugo, Les Misérables. Madame André. Chaudet du Plateau, Cantal, France. May 15th, 1944. I am ripping seats out of the bus when we hear the first explosion. My plan, thanks to a bit of creative engineering and a set of bolt cutters I've borrowed from Fournier, is to create an area at the front of my bus where I can entertain my colleagues out of the elements. I've already turned the back, where the two benches face each other, into something of a bedroom. All I'm waiting for is the mattress that Tardivar promised. At the moment, however, I'm on my hands and knees, head crammed under a seat, trying to pry it loose from the floor, when the distant, unmistakable rumble reaches us. I feel it vibrate up through the ground, across the bus, and into the palms of my hands, like something deep within the earth has torn loose and is charging toward the surface. I'm on my feet and out the door, bolt cutters still in my hand, before I've even made the conscious decision to move. I run toward the middle of the clearing, where Hubert and Fournier have already planted themselves like old weary trees, scowling toward the north. That first explosion is followed by another, then another. Distant booms that gather momentum in the early evening air. And then the gunshots begin, scattershot and rapid, echoing through the valleys that lie between us and that far-off ridge. "What's happening?" I ask Hubert.
"An attack."
"Where?"
He tips his chin toward the north.
"Sounds like Montmouchet."
"Gaspar!"
"It was bound to happen," he says,
then looks at me to gauge my reaction.
"You did warn him.
Are we going to help?"
Hubert is quiet, weighing the possibilities. How long it would take to notify each of Fournier's groups, what it would require of us, and whether we could get to Montmouchet fast enough on foot. We do not have the vehicles to transport even a tenth of Fournier's troops.
"There are thousands of men under Gaspar's command," I say. "They don't deserve to die for his stupidity."
It is Fournier who answers. He stands behind me and to my left. His voice is quiet but authoritative.
"No, but there are mountains between us, valleys, at least two rivers swollen by spring rains. By the time we can assemble our men, travel, and reach Gaspar, the attack will be over. It may well be headed toward us by then."
"So we do nothing?"
"We wait," Fournier says. "Gaspar has concentrated his forces. They have few weapons and no reserves. They will have to retreat eventually. And when they do, they will come here."
It is a strange thing to hear a battle raging and not engage. I find that my body grows tense and leans forward with each explosion. All that day we listen as the attack, swift and merciless, falls on Gaspar's compound. 50 kilometers, technically a short enough distance to walk in half a day. And yet from where we stand, a treacherous tangle of nearly impassable geography. This is why the Maquisards chose to situate themselves in the Auvergne, the fortress of France, each group claiming a piece of this daunting territory and positioning themselves on high ground amidst the plateaus. But as difficult as it is for the Germans to maneuver through these hills, it is equally difficult for us to reach one another on foot. And into this complicated mess of guerrilla warfare, Hubert, Dennis, and I have landed, knowing that, busy as we are now, the real work will begin once the Allies arrive in France. Arming and training the Maquis is only half the mission. The fighting and the sabotage that will drive the Germans out of France are yet to come. We continue with our work, raising our heads occasionally as reverberating strings of gunfire and faint distant battle cries reach the plateau. From here, it sounds like the memory of war, like some strange echo reaching across time to remind us that the Germans were here once before, that we drove them out, and we can do it again. But only if we do not waver in our resolve. So we set our minds to the task at hand. I go back to work on my bus, then spend the evening coding messages.
Dennis radios London, and we listen to the BBC French News Bulletin until they sign off with their usual phrase, letting agents scattered throughout the country know that personal messages are about to be broadcast. Et maintenant, quelques messages personnels. Hubert, Dennis, and I sit beside the radio, listening to the usual endless strings of nonsense. Bits of nursery rhyme, 18 surnames, what I can only assume is a grocery list, a recipe for cough syrup. And then, finally, the confirmation that our message has been received and our order approved. A cricket chirps in Kent. And that settles it. We will receive 3 airdrops over the next 5 days. At nightfall, the booms and echoes across the ridge begin to lessen, then stop entirely within 2 hours. It is almost midnight when Dennis pulls his headphones off and yawns. We decide to stretch our legs and go meet Fournier beside the campfire. The silence makes me nervous, Hubert says. The Germans have retreated. Fournier stands beside the fire. He holds his hands toward the flames, palms out, to warm them. The air smells of damp earth and bright green pine needles. Above us, the sky is clear and dotted with 1 million pinpricks of light. They will return at dawn. They always do. As usual, Fournier is right. After a rare night with no shipments to collect, I sleep like a concrete block and wake at 6 o'clock the next morning to a tremor and the sound of bus windows rattling. Even in my sleep-drunk state, I know that the battle has resumed and we must prepare ourselves for the fallout. The first of Gaspar's men reach us at midday. A handful of them are wounded and all of them are hungry. Those who are armed have only small weapons, revolvers and rifles, but not a bullet to share among them. We retreated when we ran out of ammunition, one of them says, staring at me curiously over the bridge of a nose that has been broken at some point in the past. We went through the Auvergne, but we lost most of our heavy equipment on the way. Why did you come to us? Why not Tardivar? He's closer, Hubert asks. The Marquisar tips his chin at me. The look on his face is something akin to wonder. Because of her. Everyone knows Madame André calls for weapons and they fall from the sky. Hubert flicks his dark gaze to me, then back to the Marquisar. I am startled to realize that he is worried about me, worried that Madame André's notoriety has spread to the point that even random Marquisars know who she is and where to find her. Fournier, ever the strategist, steps between us and sets his hand on the young man's shoulder. Tell me, he says, about the Germans. How many were there? How were they armed? What was their strategy? They outnumbered us almost 4 to 1, so 11,000, we think. But they do not know how treacherous these woods can be. They dislike approaching on foot, so they came with artillery, tanks, armored cars. We ambushed the convoys as they entered the forest, and then we withdrew before they could gather and return fire. Over and over we did this. Attack, pull away, attack again from a different angle. He looks at me as though seeking approval. We avoid as much as possible a direct battle with the Boche. Gaspar taught us to pick them off, to shave off the edges, to grind them down. It pains me to admit this, but I say, that is very clever of him. The Marquisar nods, and I see in that single movement how loyal he is to his leader. What were your casualties? I ask. About 150. Gaspar did not give the order to scatter until our ammunition was gone. And the Germans? They bled like pigs and died by the hundreds, he says, then adds, Gaspar and his chief lieutenant captured an armored car and 2 cannons. And what do Gaspar and Judex plan to do with these weapons? He raises an eyebrow, intrigued that I know this other name. Bring them here, of course. Gaspar's men trickle in throughout the evening, into the night, and all the next day. But not just his. More new recruits flock to the Chaudaigu Plateau by the dozens. Word of the fighting has spread to small towns and villages throughout the Auvergne. Men, young and old, come to us, eager to join the Marquis. eager to be part of a group known for organization and access to weaponry. I hardly see Hubert or Fournier the entire day. They meet with each man as the scouts bring them in, asking questions, gathering information. It is a porous, nerve-wracking system we have in place. Any of these men could be Milice, the French auxiliary of the German army, tasked with ferreting out members of the resistance and slaughtering them. Any of them could be German agents. We do the best we can, screening each recruit as though he were volunteering for the British Special Service. Hubert separates the wheat from the chaff by making it clear that traitors won't be jailed or sent away. They will be shot. By the end of the day, Hubert can barely stand. His voice is raw, and dark bags hang beneath his eyes. It's been 5 days since he shaved and 3 months since his last haircut, and I am amazed at how my buttoned-up partner has turned into a scruffy mountain man in such a short amount of time. How many new recruits do we have? I ask as we sit in my bus. The only seats that remain are four at the front that I have unbolted from the floor and arranged around a broad flat stump that makes a handy table, and the two benches in the back that face each other. Beggars can't be choosers. And besides, the arrangement gives me a semblance of proper living quarters. A place to sleep, and a place to meet with colleagues.
Almost 1,000. They're coming from every direction. You'd think the sound of all that fighting across the ridge would keep them away, but no, he says. And that's not even counting the men who've come from Gaspar. Those number at least 1,500 already, and there are more on the way.
I pass him the bottle of brandy that came through in our last shipment. Occasionally there is a crate marked Hélène, and it always contains a small luxury for me. Tea, chocolates, toothpaste, a hairbrush or Lizziarden lipstick. This last shipment had 2 bottles of brandy, clean socks, and a jar of face cream.
What are we going to do with them? I ask.
Assign them to groups and ask London to double the shipments.
No, I shake my head. We'll have to triple them.
They need everything, Nance. Food, boots, clothes, money, weapons. I interviewed a group this morning armed with nothing but rusty pitchforks.
But they're warm bodies willing to fight. That's as close to a miracle as we're going to get.
Fournier's numbers have nearly doubled in recent weeks. Add in those of Gaspar, and you realize what we've got here?
I nod. Enough men to disrupt the German supply lines, to stop their soldiers from reinforcing troops at the battlefront, to destroy every single target that London has given us.
If we can just put guns in their hands and keep them alive, we have the chance of winning, he says.
Gaspar reaches Chaudaigu 2 days later. He stomps into Fournier's camp as though he's the bloody Prime Minister of France.
Nance, Dennis says, from where he's sitting at the front of my bus, ear tuned to the radio, pen scratching code across a fresh sheet of paper.
I see him, I say,
pulling my pack from underneath one of the benches at the back of the bus. I dig around until I find my lipstick and the compact Buckmaster gave me. Then I carefully apply a coat of blood-red armor. I've not worn my lipstick in weeks, but the sight of Gaspar leaves me feeling as though I could use a bit of reinforcement. I look at Dennis and smile.
You are the strangest woman I've ever met, he says.
How so?
I tell you that Gaspar, the greatest herpes blister in all of France, is walking through our camp and you put on lipstick.
Would you go into battle without a bulletproof vest? I ask.
No.
Neither would I.
I wink.
You stay here. Finish that transmission. I'll deal with the festering pustule that is our dear friend Gaspar.
He lifts one perfectly arched eyebrow toward his hairline.
What? I ask.
Do we know if the man even has a last name?
We do not know, and we do not care.
The thing about lipstick, the reason it's so powerful, is that it is distracting. Men don't see the flashes of anger in your eyes or your clenched fists when you wear it. They see a woman, not a warrior, and that gives me the advantage. I cannot throw a decent punch or carry a grown man across a battlefield,
but I can wear red lipstick as though my life depends on it. And the truth is, these days, it often does. Gaspar blinks twice when he sees me approach. I am wearing army boots, slacks, now quite loose thanks to months in the forest, and a short-sleeved silk blouse because it is too hot for anything else now that summer has arrived. I tip my head to the side and take in Gaspar's bedraggled appearance. His beard has gone wild, his hair is greasy, torn pants, ratty collar. There is blood and grime smeared over most of his body. He smells like a wet, mangy swamp dog. I give him my best smile. Bringing up the rear, I see.
I have come for my men, he says.
The men who fled your compound and came to me for arms?
You mean to take them?
No, I was simply noting a fact. What do you want?
Gaspar's lip twitches, and he turns to look over his shoulder. His lieutenant, Judex, is several yards away talking to Hubert.
A conference. To discuss your terms.
Oh, it is a Herculean effort not to smile. Not to act superior. I would lose my advantage, and this war is too important for me to indulge my ego.
Very well. But I'm in the middle of something. You may meet me in my office in 2 hours.
He snorts.
Your office?
I lift an arm casually toward my bus.
2 hours.
I spend the next 120 minutes coding messages for Dennis Rake. We need London to increase the amount of supplies they send in each airdrop if we're to outfit our new recruits. I put in another urgent request for the weapons instructor I know only as Anselm. Hubert does his best, but we need a dedicated trainer to turn these farm boys into fighters. Hubert is outnumbered and out of his league, and Anselm is our only hope of getting these troops trained in time. Speaking of the devil, Hubert stomps up the bus steps and drops into one of the 4 seats I've arranged around my stump.
Gaspar is coming, he says. This should be fun.
Define fun, Dennis mutters, shuffling papers and stuffing them into his pack. It's unlikely that Gaspar can read his particular brand of Hungarian shorthand, but he won't take chances regardless.
Watching Nancy go for the jugular.
Gaspar does not come alone, nor does he knock. He and Judex are through the door and up the steps without a word of greeting. They survey my office with skepticism, but say nothing.
Please, sit down.
I motion to the benches at the rear of the bus. Gaspar eyes the empty seat beside me, but does as he's told.
You've met Hubert, and this is Denden, our radio operator. As luck would have it, he picked us up a few miles from Montmouchet the morning you turned us away.
I know it is unnecessary and possibly cruel, but I want Gaspar to understand how easily he could have been in a position of power had he not been so rash from the start. Gaspar looks at Dennis Rake, and I can see all the calculations flash across his eyes. Whatever he's thinking, he keeps to himself, choosing instead to nod once in greeting. I speak to Gaspar in a voice devoid of accusation.
Patrice is dead. Victor has rejected your overtures. There are now 7,000 Makisar in this camp, 2/3 of whom are yours, all of them without arms. And I am the only source of communication between here and London.
He does not dispute this, which is good, given how little he will like what I have to say next.
Your security is awful. So awful, in fact, that a known German double agent was able to get through your checkpoints, kill Patrice, and arrive at your doorstep before being apprehended. Your lack of emergency planning at Montmouchet is unpardonable. I told you to break your men into smaller groups and disperse them throughout the area. I told you to have escape routes prepared in the event of an attack. Had you done as I instructed, you would have been fully armed and able to drive the Germans back in a decisive victory instead of retreating here. But here you are, under my command.
Hubert's eyes widen in surprise and Gaspar opens his mouth to argue, so I cut him off.
I am chef du parachutage.
You have no other means of getting weapons, explosives, supplies, or finances. It comes from me, or it does not come at all. If you want that to be your legacy, you may take your men, those who are willing to go with you, and leave immediately.
I lean forward and rest my elbows on my knees.
Otherwise, you will consider me your bloody field marshal, and you will never argue with me again.
Judex flicks a nervous glance toward Gaspar, but says nothing. They are both proud men, and I know that abandoning Montmouchet to the Germans is more painful to them than receiving a dressing down from me.
I will arm you, I say, but only if you conform to my standards of military preparedness.
I do not ask for permission or agreement. I let them consider my words. And I wait. After a good 30 seconds, Gaspar nods in mute acceptance.
We have an understanding, then. Leave, now, and begin organizing your men into groups of 100. Each of them must have a leader who reports directly to you. And as I have done with Fournier, I will meet with your chosen leaders individually to assess their needs. Only then will I begin requesting your arms from London. You have 24 hours to begin dispersing your troops.
Gaspar rises from the bench and motions for Judex to follow him. Neither of them looks at me as they move toward the door.
Wait, I say. And Gaspar turns, eyes narrowed, jaw clenched. He's had all he can take for one day.
I pull a set of papers, folded into thirds, from my back pocket and hold them out.
What is that? He asks, as though I'm handing over a court summons.
A list of known underground cables the Germans have installed throughout the countryside as a means of communication. We believe there to be many more, however, and your job is to locate them so they can be systematically destroyed by you and your men when we give the word, I say. Prepare accordingly. Gaspar does not like me. He will probably never like me. But in this moment, I think he respects me, and that is far more important.
Madame André, he says with a curt nod.
I hand him the papers. Don't make me regret this.
Nancy Fiocca. Marseille, March 1st, 1940. I say goodbye to my husband on an unusually cold, rainy morning. The Gare Saint-Charles platform is crowded with travellers rushing to catch their trains, and I cling to him as though we are parting for eternity. I want everything to stop. I want everyone to leave. I would pause time if I could, anything for a few more precious moments together. But there is no more sand in the hourglass. Henri's bags are packed, and his train leaves for the Alsace in 3 minutes. He will be stationed somewhere along the Maginot Line, defending an ouvrage, one of the concrete weapons installations recently built along the French border as a means of resisting German invasion. To our army, he is simply a warm body, a former soldier called to duty in time of need, a number. He knows this, and I know this, but to me, Henri is the only number that matters. He pulls me close against his chest as we stand beneath the overhang, inches from the downpour. He buries his face in my neck, inhales, presses one hand to the small of my back and runs the other through my hair. It feels as though he is trying to absorb me right into his body.
I hate to see you cry, he whispers.
I hate this fucking war.
I cannot stop the tears or my ragged breath or the panic that fills my mind and makes it hard to imagine anything but disaster. Already I see a version of my future, the widow Fiocca, just another woman who loses her husband to the Nazi scourge. I cannot accept this. I will not.
Please come home. Please, please, I beg.
I will.
Promise me.
I promise you, ma fille chérie. I will come home.
Alive!
He laughs, but I don't think it's funny.
Of course, he says.
Henri Edmond Fiocca, I will never forgive you if you don't.
I must. How else will I ever hear your laughter again?
Henri brushes his lips against mine in the barest whisper of a kiss. His warm brown eyes are filled with determination. Then he takes a step backward into the downpour, and the last thing I hear him say is, "Back soon." Marseille. Hôtel de l'Uvepé, April 25th, 1940. Antoine looks at the suitcase I set on the floor beside my bar stool and raises one eyebrow.
"Taking a trip?" he asks.
"Yes," I tell him as I stick out my hand, palm up. "Scissors, please, and a menu." He slides both across the bar, and I cut the tags from my newly purchased case. I've not heard from Henri in almost 2 months, and I've grown restless. I miss him, and I can't seem to stop my mind from imagining one terrible scenario after another. At this rate, I'll be certifiably insane by summer. I need a change of scenery. But first, lunch.
Where are you going?
Cannes, for the weekend.
I like Cannes. Where are you staying?
The Hotel Martinez.
Really?
Antoine has been polishing the bar with an old rag, but he stops and looks at me with a calculating glint in his eyes.
You might be able to help me then.
Yes, how?
Would you deliver a package to the front desk at the hotel? It would save me a trip.
For you, of course. Antoine leans closer and says,
Not for me, technically. For a friend.
I cannot decide whether I'm drawn to the intrigue because it runs so counter to what I know of Antoine's personality, or because it provides a much-needed diversion.
And what sort of friend might she be?
I ask with a grin, imagining that the barman has found himself a lover.
The sort who helps Jews escape Nazi-occupied Europe?
He whispers.
Oh,
I say. And then, so this package could get us both in a great deal of trouble. 4 years ago, when Stephanie and Count Gonzalez helped me get Janusz Lieberman out of France, it took an act of God and Parliament. I can't imagine how difficult the process must be now. But I am glad to know that my friend is doing what he can. And he ought to know by now that I'm not one to run from trouble. The smile I offer Antoine is all the answer he needs.
I'll have the bouillabaisse,
I say. I leave Antoine's and go directly to see the tram conductor, Fistol, and arrange for him to care for Picon and Grenadine while I am gone. Then I return to our flat to pack my things. On my way out, I am met on the landing by Monsieur Paquet, the local commissioner of police. He lives in the apartment across from us, on the top floor of our building, and has taken a rather unnerving interest in me since Henri left.
Madame Fiocca?
He nods, then glances at my suitcase.
Are you leaving town?
Oui. The way he studies my face makes me nervous, so I lie. I am off to visit Paris with a friend.
Which friend?
He asks, unable to hide the glint of interest in his eyes.
An old one. A bientôt.
And then I am off down the stairs, elated at having something useful to do. Cannes, the Hotel Martinez. It's only an envelope. That's what I tell myself repeatedly on the train, and there is nothing in this envelope but a set of fake identification cards, 4 in total, to be delivered to the front desk of the Hotel Martinez and picked up by a guest named Simon Bolivar. The only reason I know that this is not the real name of the person who will collect the envelope is because I have a very strange memory. I remember things, irrational things, odd little tidbits that stick in my brain and remain there forever. I think of it as a box of sorts that holds information at the ready should I ever need it. Sometimes it even empties itself of random objects and hurls them at me unbidden. The middle names of half a dozen famous authors, bawdy limericks, dates, locations, faces, accents. Because of this, I know that Simon Bolivar is in fact not a real guest at the Hotel Martinez, but a 19th century military and political leader in Venezuela responsible for freeing 6 South American states from colonized Spanish rule. Whoever collects this envelope will distribute the contents to 4 desperate people within the coming days. The identification cards will allow their owners to travel freely under assumed French names from Cannes to Marseille to Toulouse, where they will be collected by Antoine's friend, a woman he calls Françoise, though I suspect that is not her real name, who will escort them to Perpignan and finally across the Pyrenees Mountains to whatever freedom they can find. The Marseille-Cannes train rattles along its track for 2 hours, and I sit in my seat, hair coiffed, belt neatly cinched, glad to be of use. I am wearing victory red lipstick. There are false identification papers tucked inside my purse, and my heart is ticking fast enough to make me sweat. I check into the Martinez under my own name, and the girl behind the counter gives my papers a cursory glance. When she hands me the key to my room, I pull the now rumpled manila envelope from my purse. "Can I leave this here for one of your guests?" I ask. "Oui." She looks at the name printed on the envelope, then checks her guest list, puts it into the appropriate mailbox, and gives me a bright smile. "Enjoy your stay," she says, then turns back to her work. Who knew subversive activity could be so simple? Heart rate restored, I walk through the lobby toward the bank of elevators. But something occurs to me as my finger hovers over the button. The hotel bar is across the lobby from the check-in desk, and I am very curious to learn the real identity of one Simon Bolivar. Whatever his name might actually be, Monsieur Bolivar is not Spanish, nor is he French. As a matter of fact, if I had to lay money down, I'd say he was British, or at the very least from somewhere in the Commonwealth. Because I am sitting beside the window, suitcase tucked under my table, chin tipped toward the sun, drinking my second French 75, when a tall, red-headed man with excellent posture walks through the lobby, speaks with the girl behind the desk, and collects my envelope. Marseille, May 12th, 1940. Word reached Marseille yesterday that the Germans have broken the Maginot Line and crossed into France. Over 1 million German soldiers and almost 2,000 tanks have entered the Ardennes Forest, a thing that every single French general said was impossible. They mean to drive the English back to the sea at Dunkirk and cut off the Maginot Line from the rest of France. In the meantime, they litter the countryside with wounded civilians. I cannot sit here waiting to deliver another envelope for Antoine, so I return the dogs to Fistol and begin the long process of driving north. Henri made good on his promise a week before deploying to the front and delivered a rickety truck that I had fitted as an ambulance, then parked behind our building. My driving lessons consisted of one literal crash course given by a nerve-racked mechanic who works for Henri's company and was terrified he might kill the boss's wife. Every day since, I have driven it into the hills, and now feel as comfortable driving a truck as I do engaging in subversive activity, which is to say my heart races every time I'm behind the wheel. There is one rather large complication, however. I did not arrive in Europe until I was well into my 20s, long enough to become quite settled with the belief that cars should be driven on the left side of the road. In France, however, as in the United States, they drive on the right side. It's one thing to be a passenger in such circumstances, but something else to be behind the wheel. It is a new habit that does not come naturally to my Anglo-Saxon mind. That long first day driving north, I inevitably drift to the left-hand side, swerving at the last moment to miss oncoming traffic. No wonder Henri was so hesitant to make good on his promise. I am a menace on the road, and more than once passing cars are forced into a hedge or fence. On my second day, I take regular breaks and try to stay more alert. I won't be much good to the war effort if I can't even reach the front lines without mangling myself in a car crash. It takes another day of solid driving to reach the northern front near Belgium, and I arrive without having forced anyone into the hedgerow in a good 6 hours. Upon arrival, I am directed to a voluntary ambulance corps that has set up headquarters in a field hospital in the small town of Marville. It is a near straight shot north from Marseille, from the bottom of France to the top, but accessible only by a winding network of narrow roads and byways. My entire body is sore and tight when I climb from the truck and face the reality of what is before me. I have been living in the land of make-believe, of blue skies and sunshine. Marseille is a naive paradise hidden from the realities of war. This is the true France, a battered, bleeding outpost filled with wounded soldiers and fleeing refugees. It smells of fear and unwashed mail. Gunshots echo in the distance, and military trucks roar through the streets every few moments. Beyond that, there is an eerie silence. "Who's in charge here?" I ask the first soldier I see. He can't be more than 17. Crooked teeth, face pockmarked with acne scars. "Of the ambulances, I mean." He points in the general direction of an old church with arched windows and a high stone steeple. "Bulgar," he says, and then shuffles off without another word. Bulgar? Or did he mean bulgur, like the wheat? What sort of name is that? These are the things I'm wondering as I mount the steps and walk into the church. The smell stops me short. Marvie's place of worship has been converted into a field hospital. The sick and dying are scattered everywhere, or what's left of them. There are more people with missing limbs and bullet holes than I can count, at least a dozen of them children. The smell of sickness and infection hovers in the air. Like rotten fruit, it cloys at the nostrils. I must look stricken because a passing nurse approaches me.
"Are you looking for someone?" she asks. "A loved one?"
"No." I blink, shake my head. "I mean, yes, I am looking for someone, but not a patient. I need to find... Bulgar?" I go with the wheat. It seems the most likely option. She is young, but her face is worn and tired, and it takes a moment for the confusion to pass.
"Oh, you mean Petar Konev?"
"Does he run the voluntary ambulance corps?"
"Yes."
"Then that's who I'm looking for."
"Out there."
She mercifully points to a cobblestone courtyard outside the church. I thank her and make a hasty exit from the infirmary. "So, not Bulgar wheat, but Bulgarian." I shake my head and take three huge lungfuls of fresh air, only to realize I've not asked her what he looks like. But there's no way I'm going back inside that building unless I'm wounded myself. I weave my way through a crowd of soldiers, almost all of them young, exhausted, shell-shocked, each of them with the hollow-eyed expression of a man who has looked death in the face. I search for Henri everywhere I look, terrified I will actually find him. These men hardly notice me as I push my way to the side of the church. It's not that hard to find Konev in the end. He's the one shouting instructions. A tall willow switch of a man with milky blue eyes, a narrow jaw, and a voice filled with gravel and dust. "Are you Petar?" I ask. He looks me over and then says in a heavy accent,
"Yes."
"I've come to volunteer."
"Go see Marie. She directs the nurses."
"No, I have an ambulance." I can see that he wants to laugh, but the expression on my face stops him.
"We have no woman drivers."
"You do now." Honestly, I'm so tired of this bullshit. I can't have a byline because I'm a woman. I can't apply for a marriage license on my own because I'm a woman. I can't drive an ambulance because I'm a woman. "Tell me where to go and who to collect, or I'll just head off on my own and cause everyone more trouble," I say. Petar gives in more easily than some of the men I've known. He shrugs as though he's too tired for this nonsense.
"Take the road north out of Marville. It won't take you long to see the steady stream of people. But try to avoid stopping for the first group you see. Those are the ones who can walk, who can get here on their own. The ones who really need your help are miles farther on. They'll have pieces blown off."
I don't get a thank you or good luck or even what's your name. Petar Konev turns away and resumes shouting orders to the other weary ambulance drivers gathered in the courtyard. "Well, I guess that's that," I mutter as I climb back behind the wheel of my truck and turn on the engine. My lower back and hamstrings begin to protest. I have already been in this truck for far too long. But I turn on the engine, put it in gear, and head north. Because I can either sit in this seat and do some good, or sit at home in Marseille, waiting and worthless. Every morning I head out in my ambulance, turning onto now familiar roads, only to find that there are bodies everywhere, more victims caught in gunfire during the night. There are bombed out vehicles on roads that were clear the day before. Sometimes I have to wait for them to be cleared before I can pass. These days are the worst, because I am left to witness the carnage up close. The bodies of children are hardest to see, scattered beside the road like so much garbage. I want to bury them. I want to weep for them. But I have to force myself onward. I can only shake my head in dismay at the mattresses strapped to the top of many of the vehicles that pass. They will not protect the passengers within from strafing by the Luftwaffe's Stukas. All too often when I head back hours later, I see the dead and dying who have been hit by those planes, proof that the mattresses did very little to deter the barrage of German bullets. In my youth, before I left Australia, I worked as a nurse's assistant in the Mudgee Mining Hospital. I know how to stitch a wound and how to stanch the flow of blood. At the time, there were fewer career paths open to young girls, and I had not yet gone abroad in search of a more interesting life. I'd not yet learned to take shorthand or write an article. My time there had its benefits, however. I can give an immunization and, when necessary, make a tourniquet. But these are basic skills, of little use when an old woman has lost her left hand because she stuck it out the window and caught a stray bullet at the wrist. Or when a bus has taken gunfire and exploded, leaving 15 people with third-degree burns. I am unprepared for the realities of battle. I have never seen injuries like these. Most days, as I drive along, listening to the cries and moans that drift up from the truck bed behind me, I pray for Henri. Though I could not surrender my Protestant past for his Catholic present, I do remember how to pray, and I know that God is God regardless of which denominational peg I hang my hat upon. I know that Henri is somewhere nearby, but I hope that he is not in an ambulance such as this, his life slipping away as he bounces over ill-kept roads. Some days I ignore Petar Konev's instruction and fill the back of my ambulance with refugees too tired to walk any longer. And other days, I fill it with the wounded men, women, and children who have been strafed by German Stukas flying low, shooting at desperate, easy targets. Often, I am too late. Often, there are too many. Always, I sleep in my ambulance, sprawled out across the seat, too tired to care that I can't remember the last time I bathed or properly brushed my hair. I eat my meals at the mess hall in Marville, but taste nothing. I focus on doing the next thing. A little over 4 weeks into my volunteer assignment, the French government decides that Marville must be evacuated. Belgium has fallen, and the Germans have pushed all the way through the Ardennes forest and are now advancing toward our location. If we stay, we will be taken prisoner. To make matters worse, a thing they are calling the Blitz is raging in England, and I am ashamed to say the French military dissolves into disorganization. We are instructed to pick up whomever we can. Wounded soldiers, civilians gunned down by Nazi machine guns, anyone at all, really, walking, limping, or crawling. So, on the morning of June 10th, I collect my last load of passengers, drop them at the field hospital, and head south. Retreat is a dismal thing. It tastes of bile and regret. And as I drive back toward Marseille, I wonder how the French military could be so grossly unprepared. I saw this coming 4 years ago. Why weren't they prepared? The reality of what is headed for us makes me sick to my stomach. It seems as though the air itself reeks with the stink of death and despair. 3 days later, my ambulance gives up the ghost. It sputters to a halt 20 kilometers from Nîmes. I tap the gas gauge. It's half full. But it's an old truck and it was never meant to endure the punishment I've put it through. I'm only 2 hours from home and I'm stranded on the side of the road.
Exhaustion and discouragement have seeped into every fiber of my being. I feel as though the very strands of my hair are limp with it. I am hungry, I am thirsty, and my damn period started this morning. I stand there beside the truck, cramps spreading across my belly, into my back and down to the tops of my thighs, and I think of every awful curse word Henri has ever taught me. I kick the tire of my poor old ambulance so hard my toes hurt. I kick it again.
Merde! Putain de merde! Fils de pute, toi! Va te faire foutre! Tu me fais chier! Putain de bordel de merde! Quel salaud! Quel con! Vous tuez connasse! Trou de cul!
I am breathing hard, practically sweating by the time I finish my tirade. Yet there is nothing left to be done but grab Henri's suitcase and begin walking. Near sunset, I reach Nîmes and secure a room at a small hotel. It does not serve meals and there is one bathroom per floor, but each room does come equipped with a radio. After a long, cold shower, I fall into bed and switch on the BBC French service, only to hear that the Germans marched into Paris earlier that day and met no resistance. Defeat and humiliation are poor bedfellows, and I lie there wondering where my husband might be. The thought hits me much like a thunderbolt. If he is alive, he will head for Marseille once his unit is disbanded. If Marville has been evacuated, then the rest of northern France has been as well. If Paris has surrendered without a fight, all conscripted soldiers will be sent home. That thought is the only thing that allows me to sleep. I begin walking again the next morning until I get one lift and then another, piecemealing my way back to Marseille, only to find that in my absence it had been bombed by Benito Mussolini. Parts of the city have been blown to bits. The harbor is in shambles, the causeway destroyed. But our flat, high on the hill, is still standing. It is 9:15 when I walk into our home, only to be greeted by silence. The curtains are drawn. Dust lies heavy on every surface. The dogs are still with Fistol. My husband is somewhere at the front, whether dead or alive I do not know. And the war has finally found us in Marseille. I slide down the wall and sit on the floor, crying at the great, awful waste of it all.
Henri. Lembach, Alsace. Ouvrage Four à Chaud, Combat Unit No. 5, June 28, 1940. France was caught unawares. Although Germany invaded Denmark and Norway in April, no one was prepared for the attacks on Holland, Luxembourg, and Belgium in May. None of the great military strategists could conceive that Germany would violate Belgium's neutral stance and march straight through to the Ardennes Forest. When the British retreated from Dunkirk, the exodus began. Paris fell. The Maginot Line was cut off, and Henri and his fellow soldiers in Lembach were trapped, helpless as the Germans marched through the Somme Valley and into France. It took only a month for his noble country to fall to its knees. In theory, the Maginot Line was a brilliant idea. Each state-of-the-art installation is connected by an underground railway and can hold over 1,000 men. Each embodies the arrogance and power of France. But the Germans do not play by the established rules of warfare. They see, they want, they take. France was the next thing in line. 3 days ago, Henri and the others sat in their bunker and listened to the radio as it was announced that Marshal Pétain, the newly assigned prime minister, had signed the Armistice Convention, giving the German army full control of the northern half of France. He listened as his countrymen stated with dull voices where the lines of demarcation have been drawn. Occupied zone and free zone. Northern France, with captured Paris as its capital. Southern France, to be administered henceforth from Vichy. Their leaders having promised goodwill and allegiance to the Führer. Papers will be required to pass from one side to another. Rations will go into effect. Movements will be restricted. Freedoms will be taken. Northern France has been rendered an occupied country. It is only a matter of time before the same will be true of the South. The idea of Nancy trapped in Marseille with leering, violent Germans makes Henri want to beat the walls around him and scream. So he lies in his bunk, taking comfort in the fact that he will be able to return to Marseille now that the French army has surrendered. He can keep his promise to Nancy. He can come home alive. And there are other promises he wants to keep as well, promises he made to himself. Henri reaches down and grabs a flashlight from his pack, then fishes in his back pocket for his wallet. There, hidden behind a number of francs, is a battered piece of stationery. Henri pulls it out, unfolds it, and lifts it in front of the flashlight. A faded gold HB is written at the top in swirling script. It is thin as tissue paper, and the ink is smudged in several places. But in perfect, legible, albeit tiny script, it reads, Nancy hates beer, cats, goat cheese. Nancy cannot sing, whistle, clap in time to music, ride a bike, teacher. It is the list he made that first night when she walked with him beside the Seine. She still hates beer, goat cheese, and cats, but he did teach her to whistle on their honeymoon. Despite his best efforts, he doubts that she will ever be able to sing a note or clap in time to music, but he can still do something about the bicycle. Henri stares at this list, his anxious mind racing, when the first bomb lands 2 kilometers away. The walls of the ouvrage begin to rattle and groan. Henri stumbles out of his bunk and into complete bedlam as the sirens screech and the lights start to flash. The deep, destructive boom of a second bomb, and then a third, even closer, can be felt through the floors, up his body and into his teeth. But it isn't until the artillery bombardment begins, moments later, that concrete dust trickles down the walls and cracks start to spread across the ceiling.